Candy episode 2 is over, but we're just getting started. Ask me about me. I'm Sarah Carradine, and I'm here with someone who would never put her whole class in detention, Grace Leader. Grace, how are you?
I'm good. I'm hoping that the episode with this one will have lots, the podcast will have lots of rhyming. I like it when it rhymes.
Did you expect the rhyme? Do you like
I like when I don't expect the rhyme and it rhymes. It's great.
Going to rhyme? And then it does. Very satisfying. Satisfied is not a word for poor Candy this episode, I'm afraid. So you have watched the first two episodes, I believe?
That's right. One and two.
Mm. What do you think so far? You think of episode one?
Yeah, really fun. I mean, you had put this on my radar. I don't know how it wasn't on my radar. Melanie Lynskey from Yellow Jackets, a delight. I will watch anything.
Yeah, from Yellow Jackets and everything else.
And everything, yeah, but mostly Yellow Jackets.
Yeah, mostly Yellow Jackets.
And then Jessica Biel, and yeah, it's and actually the supporting cast is really great too. So it was really fun. I think the style in which it's shot is really good. They're playing a little bit with time, which I very much like in my shows as well. And yeah, it's suspenseful. And I actually found in the first episode I was like feeling tense in my stomach, and I haven't really had that since like Succession, that I felt like tense about what was happening. So I think it was really effective. The first two episodes, and I'm excited to watch more.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely can see the influence of the show creators working in science fiction and horror when it comes to, you know, when it comes then to this with their Candy. So today we're going to talk about episode two. We're watching an episode episode by episode, and we're dropping it every day. So episode two is Happy Wife, Happy Life. There you go. There's your rhyme.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't expect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's better when you don't expect it.
Wow.
So the episode is written by David Matthews from the Law and Order Extended Universe and Boardwalk Empire, interestingly. So that's his connection back to the show creators there in Law and Order. And it was directed by Jennifer Getzinger. And look her up. She has extensive directing credits. Very impressive television director. But her credits include Mad Men, Orange is the New Black, and Why Women Kill. So very, very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's talk about Betty. So we speculated yesterday, Betty. We speculated yesterday that you don't get Melanie Lynskey and then kill her off at the beginning of the first episode. Mm-hmm. And we were prescient. We knew what we were talking about. Folks, sometimes we know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We get Betty, and it's 2 years earlier. What's Betty's story?
Betty, not struggling a little bit, I think, in life. Not going well in school. Maybe then, you know, it's going to take some time. Not in school. She's a teacher. So, you know, you have the most control over how well school goes, I think, when you're a teacher, as opposed to being a child. So if it's not going well, there are tough children, but to put the whole class in detention because your house gets egged, I think is maybe a step too far. My mom is a principal. Our house never got egged, but even if it did, I don't think the whole school was going in detention.
Well, I mean, this is also such an intriguing start to the episode because we start with the outside of the house at night, quiet, lights on, and immediately I was right back to, you know, the whole episode I spent yesterday worried about what was going on inside that house. So it's such a brilliant visual start to locate us. And then we see the eggs, the very yellow yolks. We love the yellow and brown, the 1970s colors all throughout this production design. Mm-hmm. And then we find out that it's 2 years earlier. And this great first shot of Melanie Lynskey, Betty, as she sits at her desk, and on the chalkboard behind her is the big word detention. Mm-hmm. And these creators don't mind about walking right up to the edge of on the nose and stopping just before.
Did you get detention, Sarah, when you were young? Did you get detention?
I don't know. I don't know.
I think I got detention once, so it's not very memorable. I was hoping it would be more like The Breakfast Club, and it just wasn't, you know?
Nothing's like The Breakfast Club except The Breakfast Club.
You know what? It'd be very ironic to get to egg someone's house and get detention, then it would turn out like the... Is that why it's called The Breakfast Club?
That's exactly why. Yeah. The listeners can't see, but I'm jumping up and punching the air and then just staying there. That's how I feel about that. Yeah, she's not having a good time at school. It's intriguing, very much based on a true story, very much the base part of based on a true story. I don't know the facts of the story at all, and I don't want to, so please nobody tell me. But what's intriguing here about the portrayal of Betty is she's not very fun. She's not very nice. Unlike the young women who get killed in many, many true crime properties who light up a room, please nobody light up a room because then your number is going to be up. As they say over on True Crime Obsessed, I'm obsessed with them. Check them out, go over there. She does not light up a room. She makes a room very dour and heavy feeling. And the creators create this so brilliantly.
I mean, I'm going to keep making egg jokes if you don't stop me. So what do you think came first? Do you think is it just the chicken or the egg situation? But is Betty sort of like miserable because people don't like her, or do people not like her because she's miserable? You know,
well, I can solve the actual chicken and egg.
Yeah, I know. I know.
It's the
I
egg.
The egg always came first. Obviously, came first. Yeah, I know.
But it's
as a metaphor.
Yes, I will take your question. Slightly more serious. Analogy. Yes. It's going to be a combo platter. I mean, it's very hard when people don't like you. I mean, I'd never experienced that, and Grace, I'm sure you're the same. But with our empathy, we can imagine what it must be like to have people not like you. And the quiet desperation that she has as she approaches the cheerful, competent mums at the church, and she just looms towards them, and we can feel her sort of pathetic desire to join the circle, and the women's tension as they try not to take a backward step because they are Christian ladies after all. And it's very hard to say to somebody, look, people don't like you because you're unlikable.
This was a very tricky thing at summer camp when I was a summer camp director or a counseling director, is when you had like a kid in a cabin who was just like not fitting in, and no side is doing anything wrong. Like one side doesn't really want to be friends with the kid who they don't really get along with. And then the other, you know, the other one's not doing anything wrong by just wanting to hang out. And obviously there's like an extra, you know, you got to include them in the game, but like it's hard when they just like didn't get along to feel like anybody's doing anything wrong. There's a level of like hospitality, that's a word I struggle to say, that I think you provide people as a nice person in society, but like what's the extent at which you have to do that? I mean, certainly don't murder them would be fine, I would say.
Yeah, right. so the line comes backwards from murder, so we say no to murder, and then we're just going to see where along the line backwards that you come. I mean, approaching a circle of people is not easy for any of us, really, particularly if we feel that our welcome is not going to be warm. But I also feel open a circle. If you're in a circle and someone's hovering, acknowledge them, speak to them. Come on, everybody. I'm sure we can do that, both literally and also, you know, on the broader social and political side. Let's open our circles. Circles can be expanded as much as we like. So she approaches the ladies of the church. They are cool. Well, cool in both senses.
They give the cold shoulder, and they're pretty cool moms.
The cool moms, and they know that they are. I think there's one. I mean, I I didn't like the school at all. I had a hard time, but look, you know, find a person who had a great time at school.
Ariel.
Okay.
He said he left high school.
But I was in a, not necessarily an in-group, but a clique, shall we say. I was a teenage girl. Teenage girls are, well, this is why Yellow Jackets is so brilliant, because teenage girls are quite sort of fascinating and terrifying. But various of us at various times were in or out of the clique, and you loved it when you were in, and you got your licks in on the out person, dreading the day that you, of course, naturally would then cycle out for no apparent reason. You didn't quite know what you'd done. You were out in the cold, and then you looked around and you realized, oh, I don't have any other friends because I've been in this clique. And then you were invited back into the warm embrace. So we learned about belonging and excluding there very powerfully. And it's a hideous lesson to learn. And we should all remember what that feels like. Not to go into my past too much.
Well, I love it.
So there's a lot of love to give. Betty would like to foster another child. Did you get the feeling that Christine was a fostered child or not?
No, but it's a good point. That actual scene, I remember when she says foster the child, I took that like I would like to try to get pregnant, because we know the baby, there'll be a baby. So I don't think it's until now that I realize that I'm remembering in that scene where she's looking to foster a child, that then they're actually going to foster a child rather than try to have a baby. So, it's not till like now that I'm realizing that's what she, like, obviously we see that they're going to have Davy. They're going to bring Davy into the family. So then I was absolutely not clued in that like the other kid is fostered.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if she is or not. I mean, because Betty says, I would like to foster another child. And then Christine loves it when we bring other right. children here. So right. whether they've had previous fosters that didn't work out it was only really on the second time through the episode that I thought. And with Christine, let's talk about Christine, the daughter. So this the foster child, Davy, comes. And there are various trials and tribulations in the Gore household. And I saw this young girl very much as the peacemaker in the house. We see her father, Alan Gore, at one point saying, look after your mother. This is an 8-year-old child.
You guys make any Al Gore jokes yesterday?
We lingered on the name, but we didn't make the joke. So the door is wide open for you, Grace.
I can't believe this guy goes on to be vice president of the United States. Well, anyway,
that was good. If you have any more in the chamber, just lob them up towards the wall of my house, and I'll let them splat.
Okay, great.
So with Christine, I feel, you know, this sort of solemn, big-eyed, kind child. She's very watchful. And we see that that family is positioning her, or she has been positioned as the peacemaker in the family, which is a role of it is sort of mantled onto you. You're the good one. You're the one that supports mother. And we see her constantly trying to not necessarily cover up for Davy, but make things right in the way of, you know, inclusion. And she can see that this child is struggling, Davy, the foster child. So I find her role in the family interesting. So even in these smaller roles and smaller moments, I think the creators are giving us a very rich story, and what we get in for the most part in this episode is the story of Betty and Betty's family. Davy, this child, tell me about Davy.
I mean, I'm very, very relatable to Davy. I was a very, very quiet child, very quiet. So, you know, and he's in this new situation, you feel for him a smidge. And yeah, they don't go into like what happens, where Davy comes from before, but you know, being a foster child, you have to imagine there's something that would, you know, there's some cause for reason that he ends up in a foster home. And so yeah, he kind of just starts lashing out. And I feel like Betty doesn't really, you know, she doesn't really know how to deal with that in a way that, you know, and I mean, not that they, you know, my parents raised me in the 90s, you know, people knew how to do it. But I feel like there is a little bit of like, you know, whatever he was struggling with, like they're not talking about what he's like, the root of the problem, you know, what is actually going on. He's just sort of angry and they get mad and send him to his room. So, which is pretty like old school style parenting, I think.
Yes. I mean, yeah. And the way that Betty is shot as she's scolding him is up from below, sort of his view of her looming grimly over him. It's very hard to blame Betty because you think she's very ill-equipped for this. She feels like you open the house and you feed the children corned beef hash for breakfast and you let them have birthday parties and that should be enough. And in no way is she equipped for whatever poor Davy's troubles might be. We can only imagine. And in fact, it isn't till later that she asks Al Gore, her husband, where did he come from? So this is, I'm sure the foster system, well, I hope the foster system is better now, but we might imagine this. There's an accuracy here whereby perhaps, you know, people's backgrounds weren't revealed or anything. But this is yet another cross for Betty to bear. And she is called, you know, Saint Betty the Martyred by the good Christian ladies of the church. And you can see where they get it from.
I mean, there she's it's almost like she's doing almost everything right and then the last thing that like Davy sort of needs is out there. So him having a birthday party, that makes sense, but sort of being like, okay, here's the leftover that are like, you know, what, not to like play with gender norms, but they're like they're dolls, you know, so he, you know, he might, they don't really say it, but he might feel some way about that. Like he doesn't get to choose. These are just the birthday cards. And it's like, okay. And then you give them out to all your friends. We don't really know. He's a pretty quiet kid, whether he has friends at school or not. There's just the ways in which like she's on the right track and then yet like not quite meeting exactly what Davy probably would need. So yeah, it's hard to blame. I mean, I certainly don't blame Davy, but I don't really blame either. So
no. Because there's the heartbreaking little moment, particularly on the second watching, where the night before he's been sent from the table without dinner because he was feeding the dog at the table and didn't stop doing it. He was sent away. And now here's the next meal of the family. And Betty says, oh, someone's having a birthday. And the way he glances up, not sure that she's talking about him, but hoping that she's talking about him. She is, of course, talking about him. She says, you know, would he like a party? And his little quiet face just lights up with pleasure. And then she gets the leftover. I mean, already the word leftover, she gets the leftover invitations and they're dolls. And he looks at the cutout doll invitations and the rest flows from there, shall we say. I mean, as Al said, didn't you call the parents? Yes, wonders whether it's Betty's own reluctance to get on the phone with these awful excluding women.
Yeah, poor Davy. He's a good little actor, who this guy playing Davy. I like when I don't like this behavior from a child, but on the TV show, when he feeds the dog and she's telling him not, and the way he just crosses his arms, is like, yeah, that's good little acting for this little kid.
Yes.
It's good.
Yes. Yeah. No, he's very good. He does as he's required. There is a moment at the saddest birthday party in the world, which is just Davy and Christine, where they're playing some sort of game, and he's growling. It's very light. The sound design in this is so brilliant. There's this very light growling and you think, who's growling? Like, is it Betty? Is it? I mean, I think it's Davy, but it could be any of the four people in the room. But I think it's Davy and his inability to speak matches hers, really. I mean, they are mirrors for each other. And then as he's driven out backwards from the drive in the front seat. It was the 1970s. It actually was the 1970s, 1978, 2 years before. Yes, children in front seats. I was surprised at how surprised I was. Oh, yes, child in the front seat.
That's the true crime here.
That is the true crime. He gives a little tiny wave to Al.
it's so sad. You just get the sense that, you know, he gets the leftover. They're not really touching on this, but whether he just wants that like dad in his life, you know, but he probably doesn't have it. He gives the tiny little sad wave is so sad.
Yes. So Davey is out of our lives and out of their lives.
The one thing I'll say again, I think I've said this on a few shows before, that are specifically ones that are doing real life events. So when we were doing, although I guess it's not true for us with Landscapes, where we don't know necessarily, we didn't know the outcome as we were watching episode to episode. And we don't know the full outcome here, but you know that Davey's not around 2 years later. So you know mm-hmm. that something here doesn't go well. And the fact that the show can still sort of build tension and sadness and emotion, and you get invested in the story, that like we know in some way how it's going to turn out, not entirely how it's going to turn out. Like, there's a world in which I'm watching a true crime show and I'm like, oh, that kid isn't around, that's alarming, you know. I don't necessarily like that. And so to see him, he just gets like taken away, they sort of give him up, is very sad, but good on the show for like, you know, yeah, we know he's not going to be around, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Betty would like reassurance from Al that she hasn't done anything wrong. He tries to give it, but we sense already his concern about her behavior and her mental state, but again, his inability to talk it through. So that's for Betty. Any more for Betty from you?
No, I mean, as you said, you know, you don't bring Melanie Lynskey on to just be in one episode. So happy to see her in this episode. An interesting choice. I mean, it's interesting to hear that the show, 40 years after this crime happens, as you spoke yesterday, like HBO's doing it too. So suddenly, like 42 years later, they're like, we got to cover this story that happened. Is very interesting, and yet. Like, I don't know this. This is not like the, you know, this is not something that I've heard covered a bunch in true crime stuff that I've listened to. So I guess they decide that they want to make sure that we know that like by the end of episode one, that like Candy is going to kill Betty. But yeah, you want Betty in the whole show in some ways, or most of it, which makes me happy. But I'm also wondering whether you needed to do the, like, is that how you needed to end episode one? I'm not sure. But I'm glad to see Betty here. It's good backstory stuff. Yeah.
Yes. And with hopes for more, because we're still 2 years before her death. So before we move on to our other leading lady, Candy, let's just take a quick break. And we're back. So the first that we see of Candy in the episode, right at the beginning of the episode, is the corridor down which poor Davey has been sent to go to his room, slightly differently lit, with the sound of the running shower, and then here's Candy in the shower with her clothes on, covered in blood. Mm-hmm. It's so wonderful, sort of situating us back in, yes, this is the house, and yes, this is the deed. So what did you think of Jessica Biel in this role here, two episodes in?
I think she's pretty good. I've never been a humongous Jessica Biel fan. Like, I'm a struggle to even name something that I've watched her and then I'm like... Or yeah, and I'm not like seeking her out, but I think she's really strong here. I think she's really good. She's doing this thing that a lot of people, I feel like to do now, where it's like, I'm gonna play a real person, and you're gonna put me in like a, you know, I'm gonna have a totally different look than what my normal look is. How could I forget about the movie Next, which I'm sure Josh brought up yesterday, the Nicolas Cage movie, which Jessica Biel is stars in. But yeah, I think she's doing great. She gets, you know, fun little bit of accent work and a quirky character.
Quirky. Yes, and that and the wig. Yeah, it's so quirky. Oh, those murderers, they're so quirky. Alleged. Yes. Mm-hmm. It must be said that the show has not yet told us explicitly that the character in this show, Candy, has killed the character in this show, Betty.
True.
But they certainly, there is a heavy implication. Yes, I'm loving the curly 70s perm. I'm loving the little outfits. We're going to get her in the athletic wear later at volleyball. Nothing like the athleisure of today.
Her rainbow like church suit is phenomenal. It's great.
Her church.
I think I would like one
pantsuit. We used to call that a pantsuit when women were not necessarily wearing pants on a regular basis. I lived in the 70s. I was a teenager in the 70s. And not to wear pantyhose was quite noted, if you can believe it. And certainly women didn't wear pants to work, for example. Even in the early 80s, I had a friend who started a job and wearing a pair of pants was told, no uncertain terms, that she could not wear those pants. So for those young women who feel that the tag of feminist is not for them, I don't expect you to be grateful, but do please know where we've come from. Even in my lifetime, when I first started looking for work when I was 15 and for probably the next 7 or 8 years, the want ads were divided into women and girls, men and boys, and you didn't think a thing of it. So this world that they're in, although Candy and Betty are older than I was then, and the children are younger than I was then, I do remember this world. And particularly, look, all the phones. We have some wonderful rotary phones going all the way through. And Pastor Jackie gets the prize for the best one with her sling phone that she's going to use later.
Good. Very funny. Rich and I are watching Under the Banner of Heaven, which I believe is also set in 1970s. I'll have to double check that. And so, yeah, I'm very much loving this. It's like a little, like late season Mad Men. We got a lot of that energy going on. That's the style.
But you have to remember, we look back. I mean, not you have to remember, you don't if you don't want to, but we look back on that era as the past. It is indeed the past. But when you're living in the era itself, you feel yourself to be a modern. You know, we felt we were modern. We were wearing jeans. The boys were growing their hair long. They were having fights at school because their hair touched their collar. So, you know, people were being policed for their clothes and hair and appearance then as now. So they feel very sort of contemporary and modern. Candy seems to be sort of queen of her own world, sort of quietly queen of her own world. Everybody mentions how competent she is and how many good things she does, and she's slim and she's groovy.
When she's singing like the lead in the choir, right? And so people, and then as sort of Betty is leaving, you see people going like, you're amazing to Candy. So she's not super like out there as like this, like, you know, I am in charge. She's just, I think the word is more like she appears competent at many things. She sort of has her life put together in a way that some of the other people don't, without being, she doesn't feel, you know, braggadocious.
She's not the preening queen bee, but she, that sort of, that confident grasp on her life to the outside world. We are to find inside the home that things are a little bit different. Here we meet Pastor Jackie, who is, they're obviously friends. Jackie reveals that she is going to get divorced. This news is going to send a ripple through this whole small community that we have been introduced to. This news is announced at the next church service by someone else, a man, and the upset that this gives is real. People are genuinely shaken and upset, and I think this is sort of very accurate for the time. I remember my mother in her later years telling me with great regret that in the 70s, where what you did in the suburbs was go around to each other's place for dinner in couples, so you'd have three or four other couples over and have dinner parties, and you kept a very careful note of who you owed. I owe them. What did we have last time? Who? There was a marvellous sort of dinner party book of everything that was served and everybody who was there. Regrettably, once people were divorced, they were no longer invited to these in-home dinner parties, and when she told me, she was sort of almost not believing that that's what they all did, but it was just it's what they all did. So it not only rocks your own security in your own marriage, where you see it's possible, like you can't be what you can't see. If you're seeing someone getting divorced, it's like, oh, that's actually now possible. But it was also a social cutoff in some communities for the divorced people, although Jackie seems to keep up with her girlfriends, who are very excited about her new boyfriend in a month or so.
Well, there's also like the way that which they're sort of like, there's the church ladies are so aghast that the fact that Jackie has gotten divorced, and Betty is sort of, or sorry, not Betty, Candy is the one sort of being like, it happens. Like, you know, it does happen. People, whatever. She's actually very like modern in this, she says something else a little bit later. She says, you know, it happens. And someone says, not around here. It doesn't, which growing up in a small town and a very conservative small town, there are people who are divorced and all that sort of stuff. But like that idea that like, none of this stuff happens in our little small town, you know, that felt really like the real sentiment from like the place where I grew up, where, perhaps not about divorce by the time I was like, you know, growing up in the 90s, early 2000s, but certainly other things.
Yes. Nothing happens in small towns except for everything.
Yes, that's right.
So Candy's obviously very fond of Jackie. They share a love of racy novels with good bits in them. And we see Candy putting one of these racy novels to pretty good use in a lovely soapy bath.
I've never understood reading in the bath. You get the book will get all wet. That's ridiculous, but I've never read in the bath ever.
Really?
It's, yeah.
Oh, you don't know what you're missing.
The book gets wet. Yes. I can't get the book wet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Perhaps when these books are clandestinely passed from lady to lady, you can tell who's been in the bath by the buckled pages.
I'll laminate my book and I'll read it.
Aha! Uh-huh. Because the other thing that we all knew in those times where pornography and certainly soft pornography was available, but you had to go sort of out of your way to find it, certain books that had been read before would fall open at a certain point, and you would know, just put the book on its spine and let it fall open naturally, and you will find the gold. Candy's efforts here at good self-care and management are thwarted by knocks on the door from the children and then a knock on the door from her husband, not sadly wishing to join her, but wanting to know what a skate key is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, she is reminiscing about her marriage, presumably prompted somewhat by Jackie's news. She's listening to David Soul. Don't give up on us, baby. I mean, David Soul, come on. He was he was gorgeous. On her very big headphones as she looks through her trunk of memories, cards from her husband, love keepsakes, and she looks over the mezzanine railing to see him, all 7 foot, 85 of him, sprawled on the couch watching the Rockford Files.
He's so tall, this guy.
He's so tall.
Yeah, he's so tall.
Very good casting here, and he's doing a very good job of making us forget Josh from Veep. He's the fun dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's the fun dad. Pat's the fun dad.
Yeah. I've seen a few of the again, my camp background. I've seen a few fun dads. Yeah, they're kind of annoying.
Yeah. Because often they will not take the parental role; they take the friend role. Although we haven't sort of seen any disciplinary problems with these perfect Montgomery children,
apart from
knocking on the door while their mother is trying to masturbate. But, you know, very hard to instruct a child not to do that.
That's true.
But she Candy, has a plan to reignite the marriage by reading these erotic poems to him. We saw her in the first episode as a storyteller with the little tree story for the children, and now this is the grown-up story of the glittering eyelid and the luscious thighs.
Yeah.
Pat not so aroused.
No, it doesn't really work for Pat. No.
No. Yeah. He loves the rhymes.
There's a term I've been seeing thrown around in the Post-Records Discord, which was doofus king. And everyone's, well, there's a new Doofus King. I think in the show, I think Pat might get to claim the title of Doofus King. I think, perhaps. Think any other strong contenders for Doofus King in Candy?
Doofus. Yes, no. Yes, it's definitely Pat. There's something called King of Stonks coming, and I saw that on the internet, and I looked that up carefully, and I can't sort of see what that is, so I'll report back if I can. Okay. So Candy gets the pastor leaves. So this is one of the results of being divorced. Presumably you can't be a pastor anymore, though she says to Candy, I'll always be your pastor. Mm-hmm. So they have a conversation on the phone where Candy is positing that a marital affair, an extramarital affair, why is it such a bad thing? Like, why? Which is like it's a very good question. People are still exploring that now and the manner in which you can negotiate these things. It is very complicated. But for Candy, speaking to Jackie, it's like, well, if you don't have feelings for the person, why is it a bad thing?
Yeah. So I think a couple of interesting things here, I think, which is what I think this is an interesting question. I think in terms of how bad is cheating on somebody, which is somebody not in a relationship currently. I don't know that I fully it sucks to be cheated on, but also it's like the worst thing you could ever do. Whatever. I don't know. I don't need to get into it. The other thing here I think it's interesting is she is getting some advice that would be not given probably by most, priests, being like, go do this thing that you go try this thing. Which I think knowing where Candy ends up is a really interesting place. So if we're sort of episode one is like, here's sort of the thing that happened with a lot of mystery. And now let's jump back 2 years in time and see how, where we kind of started in quotation marks, and we'll get back to where we are with the full sort of breadth of all the things that went into what happened in episode one. It's interesting to note that in this episode one, her priest is being like, yeah, maybe try an affair, knowing where Candy presumably, again, allegedly will end up murdering Betty.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Jackie is interesting for a pastor, cautious, but you have to think it through. I mean, thinking things through is a good idea. Okay, everybody, let's think things through. So we have had established earlier that both Al Gore and Candy play volleyball on a Thursday night. Now we're going to see another volleyball game. This time we see Candy preparing very carefully with lots of mascara and some rather aggressive coral lipstick, liberally applied. And she is out on the volleyball court, as are other men in 1970s athletic gear, which was singlets, and very, very sweaty. Everybody's very sweaty, Candy herself included. And she is shopping. She's shopping the men on the volleyball teams, perhaps one might say. Or a different way of putting it would be she's appreciating the sweaty men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a good system. Just go to volleyball practice. Yeah. We had full volleyball scenes in this episode. It's great.
Yes. They didn't seem quite so sweaty in the first one, but certainly we get it here. I must compliment Jessica Biel on her arms. So she is aroused, but also thinks she's being practical, I think. So she's not only shopping for who does it for her, but with the idea that she's going to enter this affair in a very planned suburban mother way, in the way that we have seen all through both these episodes, the way she has to plan out the kids and the church and the cooking and the go and do this and go and do that, this endeavor being a full-time job, although we never see her vacuuming, as we had another wonderful aggressive vacuuming scene from Melanie Lynskey in the first episode to drown out the baby's cries, and in the second episode to drown out the children's screams. So we really understand there's something about the performance, but there's also something about the creators, the writers and directors and original creators of this show, where we really feel like we see inside these people's minds. It's a fantastic trick. We are overlaying a lot of that on the actors. We're doing a lot of the work for them. But I like this, the camera's regard of Candy as she plays volleyball but checks out the men both erotically and also almost practically. It's as if she's looking at them and thinking, through their circumstances and which one will be the most suitable. And were you surprised when she made her pick?
From a show telling perspective, no. I guess yes and no. It's obviously there was going to be more to why she would choose. It does feel very sudden last episode that she would do something to Betty. And so there end up being sort of this, that their lives are perhaps more intertwined even than you think, that they are just two church going mothers whose kids happen to be roughly the same age. So I guess I have to say, I'm surprised that this is where it went, considering what we know of Alan so far. He does not exactly seem like, which I think that was, I don't know whether that's well done or not well done. The fact that this wasn't on my radar that it was going to be him being involved in an affair. But then as soon as you're in the volleyball court, I'm like, okay, yeah, it's going to be Alan.
And particularly as Betty has asked him not to go to his volleyball this night, because this is the very night that Davey is taken away. So unbeknownst to Candy, she's actually picked a very good moment to make her pitch. Alan's in his car, ready to drive away. She jumps into the very squeaky vinyl front seat of the car beside him, and she says, "I find you attractive, and I'd like to have an affair, okay?"
So formal. Did you file the paperwork for the affair? Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's, yeah.
I, on one hand, I kind of admire the practicality.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be all a frenzy of darting tongues. I mean, we can have that later. She then leans over and kisses him, or plants her sweaty face next to his sweaty face. It's rather perfunctory. And then she squeaks out of the car, leaving him sitting there.
Yeah. Not tonight, but I'd like to have an affair. You think it over. I'll be back later.
Yes. Let me know by COB Friday.
Yeah. As per my previous email, if you'd like to have an affair, let me know.
Yes.
Yeah.
I haven't had your response. Perhaps this has been overlooked. Question mark.
Did it go to your junk mail? I'd like to see your junk mail.
All right. That's okay. All right.
I love this thing at the end. It always says, this is not entirely, you know, it's based on true events, but some events have been fictionalized. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So just before we leave, a little coda of Candy, different hair. Now she really has that 80s swoop bob that was very popular. So we know from that the time's passed. She's in a formal suit. She appears to be in court. We hear an off voice saying, I must say with the sound design, there's a lot of sounds off, and sounds off in horror is really good. And in this, so far, these two episodes, the use of noises and voices from off has been extremely, extremely good. From off camera, I mean. We hear the voice off camera, Candace, what did you do then? And Candy says, I grabbed the axe.
Oh, right. Yes.
So what if we had been sort of squinchily enjoying the strange proposition for an affair and sort of getting quite pleased and excited about that, the creators say to us, don't forget where it ends.
Right.
Somebody dies. Whether Candy did it or not, we at this point do not know. But the end of this is that somebody dies, and I think that's really good. There was a moment very early on in the episode I wanted to note where Alan and Betty are, actually it might be when Davey gets driven away, Alan and Betty are in the garage, standing quite apart from each other, and on the wall of hanging tools between them is an axe. So that's being placed there.
Yes. So you're, is there somebody else? So we know Alan is away when this happens. Do you have anybody else on your list of people that you think could have been involved in, if you think, you know, it's not Candy?
Davey?
Davey. Oh, wow, Davey. Yeah.
Two years older. I said last episode that I knew nothing. I do stand by that. The thing I did know was that Candy was accused of murdering Betty. So I did know that. We weren't told that in episode one. We kind of still don't know it in episode two, but the answer is I grabbed the axe. And we know from the final last shot of the first episode, there's a bloody axe beside her. So now we're being told that Candy is accused of murdering Betty. But yeah, so you've just seen these two episodes. Are you going to watch on?
I am going to watch on. Yeah, it's been good. I am recovering from COVID, so I will lie down on the couch and watch more. Probably fall asleep and have to restart them many times. But I will watch it. What is up with the episode numbers, Sarah? Why are shows increasingly? I've heard about this new term in the world. It's called shrinkflation, which is where like Lay's chips recently started putting less chips in the bag but charging the same amount of money. Are we getting shrinkflation with their TV? 5 episodes of a season?
I'm just so shocked by getting less chips that I couldn't really listen to the rest of your. That's
have you heard
horrifying.
Of shrinkflation?
I haven't, but I'm going to be looking for that in my junk mail now.
It's like when you know, there's less cereal in your box, but you pay the same amount for your cereal. Mm-hmm. You get slightly less on the toilet paper roll, but you pay the same for the toilet paper.
So you're not noticing. Yeah.
We're not noticing, yeah. But I pay the same amount for my subscription and there's less episodes. Yeah. Shrinkflation. I think it's happening to our TV.
I like 5 episodes. Even before I started, I thought, well, the makers were very confident. They said, we have this story to tell and we will take the exact amount of time needed to tell it and no more. Yeah. I think 5 is a fantastic number. 4 is a great number. 2, 7, like all the numbers are great. Let's rank the numbers. We did, you know, stagger. I staggered resentfully through Inventing Anna. And the only reason I did was I want to speak so badly of this production and I feel I can't really do that unless I actually watch all of it.
That was nine, right?
So bloated. I mean, mm-hmm. apart from all its other problems, for example, I never got the wire that it promised me. The 9 episodes were completely outrageous and it was very bloated. But let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how economical. I spoke last episode about the economy of the storytelling. Mm-hmm. And this idea that there's only 5 episodes also speaks about a confidence in very economic storytelling. And I'm appreciating that here.
And do you feel like this is so you think this is for sure a miniseries? Like there's no does this crew decide to come back to some? I mean, we're too early probably to tell. Maybe you can chat more about that in episode 5 after episode 5. Is there, you know, perhaps this team thinks there's another story worth telling, even if they can't return back to this thing. It's a very few amount of episodes, even for a miniseries, but yeah.
Yeah, the Candy Extended Universe, perhaps.
That's right.
I mean, we must remember that they worked on Law and Order, so talk about extending the universe and carrying on. Grace, what have you got going on and where can people find you?
Oh, I have a fair amount going on, although I feel like I have wrapped up a tremendous amount of things recently. Finished Russian Doll, The Wild, Heartstopper, and Winning Time all wrapped up recently. So you can check all those out in the either in the Post Recaps feed or the Binge Show feeds. Currently covering Shining Girls with Dr. Amanda and Dr. Melissa. The doctors are in. I wasn't able to join them last week, but I'll be back this week. Doing weekly movie coverage with Ariel and doing sports over on Rob as a Podcast with the Off Speed Podcast. So this week we talked about hurling, an Irish Gaelic sport, with Aiden, and then we found Mike Bloom and MLB team, so it was very fun. So if any of that sounds like something you want to hear me talk about more, I can follow me on Twitter at Hi From Grace.
It all sounds like something I want to hear. I can definitely recommend all of those things, both the shows and the coverage.
I didn't say the one that I think is the most applicable to that, which is Under the Banner of Heaven, which is a true crime a TV show also on Hulu. And it's starring Andrew Garfield. And it's about the Church of Latter-day Saints and a murder in within the Church of Latter-day Saints. And it's actually in the early 80s, or like I said, it was late 70s, it was early 80s. And it has some you know, true crime in the 80s. So, it's been good. Phil and I have been going through that.
Mm. Wonderful. You can follow me at Sarah Carradine, and there I will tell you everything that I'm doing because I don't hold back and I'm not shy. I have a true crime review podcast called Crime Scene, S-E-E-N, over on Rob Hadza Podcast with the great Murray Forth. So if you have not yet got enough crime in your life, safe crime, where you're watching it or listening on your headphones, please follow me over there. So it's time to say bye, y'all. And remember, we've got so much love to give in this family.